Accession number 27185, reel 45.
Major Barras, reel 45. You were saying that when you entertain Greek generals, there had to be a very formal dinner.
Yeah, well, it was a normal guest night. I mean, we didn't do anything special for the generals. I mean, we did what we always did, was have the guest night, which was formal dinner. I often wonder what they thought, because as soon as dinner was over, went into the anteroom, everybody had coffee, and they probably ordered a round of drinks. And then the jackets were off and the game started. And I remember the generals were standing there sort of looking on with total amazement. One minute everybody's almost sitting to attention having meals with all the silver on the table and the colours against the wall with the covers taken off, candles lit and waiters handing around things and taking away things. And there we were, jackets off, playing Cockalorum and Moriarty, and then there were the competitions who could get round the room without touching the floor. All that was going on. It was absolute amazement of the general standing there with a sort of drink in his hand, watching all this going on, and couldn't understand why everything could change so quickly from one thing to another.
Was there ever a Greek general who showed signs of wanting to join in?
I think we got them to join in. We didn't ask them to go around the room without touching the floor. It had probably broken his neck. But I think we got them in, yes, on some of the Moriarty was one we used to play. I don't know whether you know that one, where you'd lie on the floor blindfolded with a paper screwed up on your right hand, and you lie opposite each other head to head. And then you say, "Are you there, Moriarty?" And the other person says, "Yes." And then tries to move his head out of the way before he's whacked on the head with the paper. And then there was High Cockalorum, which was really a piggyback thing, where one person got on the back of another and tried to pull somebody else who was on another chap's back. Pull him off. Whoever pulled the other guy off first was the winner.
But piggyback fights.
What?
Piggyback
fights. Yes, but they usually ended up in a complete mess on the floor.
And mess rugby used to be a popular game too.
Yes, that's right. Yes, yes, yeah. But there was never any. Nobody went around breaking windows or doing. As I say, the worst thing that ever happened was this guy got hold of a fire extinguisher.
Did you ever play the tunnel game?
I don't know that one. Perhaps it was called another name.
It's where you make a tunnel using the armchairs and sofas, and then teams enter from opposite ends, and the team to get all its people out of the other side's end first wins.
No.
So it comes to a head-batting match in the middle of the tunnel.
God. You want the dimmest witted ones up front, I should think, got nothing inside between their ears, so they're going to bang each other on the head.
Or if they're very drunk.
Or if they're very drunk, yes. No, we haven't had that one. We used to have courses where you put all the chairs and things and piled up and you had to get over them.
Steeplechase.
Yeah, steeplechase, yes. Round the room. And there are other things we used to, I can't remember now, but they were the usual standbys. And singing round the piano, of course, was another thing, if there was a piano now. That used to be fun. That was it.
So at Warminster, it sounds as though you had additional duties besides the ones you were doing earlier on as adjutant when you were at Paris and Evans, if you were looking after subalterns.
Well, I always did have to look after sub, and I had to do that in Salonika as well, right from the very start.
Then.
Yes. Well, I took it upon myself to do so. I don't know whether it wasn't sort of written down in my terms of reference or anything. Not that I had any terms of reference. I had to pick things up as I went along and took on things which, as they cropped up, or didn't take on things which I thought somebody else should do. Or I had a pretty free hand, actually. I mean, up to a point. I mean, obviously, there's certain areas I couldn't go beyond, didn't want to go beyond. But I enjoyed working with Dennis Ruster. He was a very excellent CEO to work for. But when we got to Warminster, I think we got the freedom of the city in Warminster. I remember we marched through there. And this is where I had inaugurated... well, in actual fact, we started them in Beresford Evans, adjutants, RSMs and adjutants parades, which I used to take and the RSM used to take. He would concentrate more on the drill when the whole battalion would parade, and I always insisted that the band and drums always came on the battalion parades. They made a difference between the way people marched and behaved, I found. The RSM used to concentrate more on the drill side, the detail of arms drill and so forth. Mine was, the adjutant parade was more on the formation marching and the way people formed up and where the battalion was drilled on a ceremonial basis. I used to take them once every other Saturday morning, I think it was, and the RSM would... We didn't have it every Saturday, and now and again the CA would have his parade, he called a parade, and have a battalion parade. But I would, first of all, I would inspect the battalion all the way down the line. There's only one occasion I sent a bloke off at the double under escort, simply because he's the same chap I'd checked at a previous parade for not being dressed properly.
What was wrong with his dress?
I can't remember now, but he wasn't up to scratch, and he hadn't taken any trouble to get himself properly up to scratch again. So I got the RSM to double him off the parade ground under escort. Now, CO, I didn't unto my... without my knowledge, the CA was watching from behind. And he said, I saw that. He said, I thought that was a good wheeze. And I said, it wasn't a wheeze, sir. That chap admitted the same thing as happened on the parade before. But it had a marked effect. Because I found out that previously, before companies were marched onto the parade ground, as they came on, the markers were called first, obviously, and then the companies marched on, they were inspected by the sergeant major or the senior officer who was present, because on adjutant's parades all the subalterns and captains had to attend. Majors, no, of course not. But after that I heard that the company commanders inspected their companies before coming on, so they learned a bit more about their own companies. But that's the only occasion I had to do it. Otherwise, then you'd have special parades for special occasions, like having to provide guards of honour. We had Slim came down when he was CIGS at School of Infantry, and I had to provide a guard of honour for him. I got a shock on that one, I remember now. I was sitting in the office working out details for it and wondering who we should have as the guard commander, and Dennis Ruster happened to walk in and said... he said, what are you doing? So I said, I'm getting the guard commander teed up, Slim. He said, who's the guard commander? I said, well, I haven't worked that out yet. And he said, well, I want you to do it. And the biggest shock I've had in my life. I said, sir, I went out and did it. I never forget Slim, actually. I can see him now standing there with a peak. All I could see was a peak and a chin. He got this big chin coming out from under his peak of his cap there when he was standing in front, and I gave the order, general salute, present arms. And of course we had to do sword drill as well for those occasions. So that was something the RSM used to take, junior officers on sword drill, or anybody who was on a guard of honour, in command of a guard of honour, would have a sword, and then they had to do it. But of course he didn't get the full guard, because he only did that for royalty.
How many men would he have on guard?
I tried to work it out, actually. I used to know about 50, I think. The royalty would have 70 72, something like that, full guard, with three officers and the colour, of course. Queen's colour, or King's colour as it was then, but of course he got the regimental colour, and the general salute was played by the band, whereas with royalty, depending on who it is, they only got the first few bars of the national anthem, as only the monarch got the full Monty, so to speak.
The whole verse?
Yes. I'm not sure whether the Prince of Wales got it as well. I can't remember, but I do know that because we had to provide a guard of honour for the Queen Mother when she came down to Warminster. Well, she was the Colonel-in-Chief of the Bedfords.
Did she take an interest in the regiment?
Oh, yes, I believe she did. I think... Well, of course, the Colonel of the regiment... I wish I could remember his name now. His brother was a famous judge.
Not Denning.
Denning, that's right.
Sir Reginald Denning.
Yes. That's it, Lieutenant General he was. He was a frightening character, according to people who knew him. He wasn't, what I gather from the way people talk, because I wasn't, as you may remember, I wasn't allowed to meet him because I wasn't a Bedford. but people who knew him didn't exactly think he was a barrel of fun. He was very, very efficient. But he was very sharp. And I think people found him a bit difficult to talk to and deal with. Some people might have done, more mature people probably. But he was a total Bedford, and I think he did a lot for the regiment. But he hadn't actually been a commander in battle, I don't think. I think he was more of an administrative general later in his life. I may be wrong, I don't want to do it. He was regarded with respect, but not much affection, I think, as far as I can make out. He was the one who would deal with the Queen Mother most of the time, I think, as Colonel of the regiment. I don't know whether Dennis Rossley ever had to go and meet her or talk to her. Of course, it was very difficult for me, as an outsider, so to speak, although I felt a complete Bedford very early on, because they were very kind and accepted me and made me welcome. But I felt a complete Bedford. But, of course, when it came to domestic regimental affairs, I was in a difficult position. And although Dennis used to talk to me about them sometimes, and when we went to the depot, he talked to the people there, the regimental association and all that sort of thing, I wasn't included in their talks. And I found it sometimes a little difficult talking to people at the depot who didn't quite understand, perhaps, why somebody in the Essex Regiment was adjutant of their regiment. But they didn't show it in any way, because they were very, very welcoming and hospitable. They were lovely people in the regiment. They were all very nice.
I'm still, to some extent, a foreigner.
Well, a foreigner, yes. Yes. But in the actual battalion, they didn't seem to regard me as such. I mean, they come and talk to me about their regimental affairs, the company commanders. I had no problem of talking straight to battalion commanders, to company commanders, helping them if I could with their affairs, or they come to me and complain about something or whatever. And then we were quite chatty in the mess, and there was never any sort of standoff. There was one guy who came about the same time as I did from the Northamptons. Now, he was older than I was, and he was more mature in his ways. Now, he arrived, I remember, with his old regimental badges up still. Now, as you may remember, I thought I'd get it over and done with before I went. It didn't occur to me that I was trying to curry favour or any of that sort of thing by doing it. But it went down well. But he arrived with all his badges up for his old regiment, and that didn't go down very well, and it took some time, and he didn't like being pushed into this regiment. I think he'd been passed over from his own regiment.
And then pushed sideways.
And then pushed sideways into another regiment. And he used to try and talk to me sometimes about, in a derogatory fashion, about some of the things. And I had to go away. I mean, I wouldn't talk to him about it. I just left him. This was before I became adjutant, when I was still in the company. I think after a bit he got sort of into the swim of things.
Was he a company commander?
He became a company commander, yes.
Do you know if he had an easy time getting a group of his company, or was there any?
I don't think so. Not from the men. I don't know whether some of this. It would depend very much on the way he handled them. Actually, I mean, if he was a good company commander, a good officer, and handled his men properly, took an interest in their affairs, was efficient, somebody they could trust, and they'd take to him.
His practicalities that really.
It really is. Yes, it comes down to personality as well. I wouldn't say that he had a fetching personality, but as an individual. But there were others. I was just thinking, there was Alan Clark, Major Alan Clark, who had been an AQMG, actually. He'd been a lieutenant colonel, got an OBE, and he was a company commander. He'd come down to major, coming back to the regiment. He always reminded me of he was quite tall, elegant, well-dressed when he went out. He always reminded me of a sort of City Bank manager. I don't know why when I saw him going off, but he didn't have a terrific sense of humour exactly, but he was efficient in an administrative way. Then there was Dougie Dutoit, who was a good games player, steady, joined as a bands boy, played a lot of games, very steady, another pipe smoker, very nice character. He left, I think he'd injured his knee or something, had no more prospects in the infantry, and joined the pay corps, and finished up as inspector general or something high up in the pay corps. He was in charge of UK pay. Who else was a Phipps? He was known as Fippo. I never knew his surname, his Christian name. And he was a very steady chap who totally you could rely on. And then there was Cyril Hefford, I think I mentioned it before, as a guy who went round with scissors cutting off people's ties. He was a Roman Catholic, I remember, and got his wife with him. And he was a lot of fun, and he was a good chap too, he was a good company commander. So he had a good set of people there. And most of these, I think I mentioned before, warrant officer sergeants, were long service, still hanging on. Who were very good, backbone of the battalion. Robinson, the RSM, left and retired. And I remember at his farewell party I went to in the sergeant's mess, the CO made a speech and said some very favourable things about him, and said he drove a straight furrow. Now that's code for really that he wasn't open to new ideas, but he was a very good RSM. And his place was taken over, I remember, by RSM Moody, who was a Bedford, who was also very good. He's a long service soldier.
Did he drive a straight furrow as well?
And he was a bit more flexible.
He could wiggle his furrow.
He wiggled his furrows a bit, yes. Mm. I think Robinson was a very good RSM. There was something lacking in his personality. I'm not quite sure what it was. He was very sort of withdrawn, so that he wasn't sort of outgoing when it came to human relationships. Whereas Moody, you could chat, talk to, have jokes with, and he'd go around and talk to the men and so forth. And I'm sure Robinson did it, but he wasn't quite so in such a outgoing, warmish sort of way. But on the other hand, he was a very good RSM. So Moody took over when we were at the School of Infantry. It was about this time, I think, when John Kitto... John must have joined us in Nook Camp. I called it Nook Corner, didn't I? Nook Camp it was. when we were just when we were at the school of when we well same as School of Empress, still there, aren't we? No, we've moved. What am I talking about? My mind's going backwards and forwards. Yes. We're at School of Infantry. Yes. John joined us when we were at Nook Camp, when we were John Kitto as a major. Yes. He joined, no, as a captain, I beg your pardon. He joined us at Nook Camp, and he took over a company. And I got very friendly with him because he was he had a sort of more same outlook as I did. And we, on the when we were alone, we used to sort of have jokes about the army and our procedures and things, and God help anybody from outside who did the same thing, but we used to, you know, take it apart now and again, fun. And we went off to the south of France again for our holiday. I remember we decided to go, I don't know where it was, I think we went to Nice this time. We went across the channel and down by blue train again, had fun down there and came back. The thing I remember about that was John was, always got seasick when he was on a ferry or any ship, and his sister, it was the ferry we went across on, Buck, he was bucking all over the place, and he stood outside, and he stood with one hand on the rail looking to the front of the ship, and now and again a whole shower of sea would come over and drench him, and then when it had cleared, there he was still grimly holding on to the rail with water dripping off his hair. He had a blonde sort of crinkly hair and a blonde moustache, but he looked like an old Viking standing there with all this water dripping down him. I just sit inside and watch him through the window, because it didn't affect me too much. But yeah, I think he was glad we got off the other side. But luckily again, of course, being near home, because my parents now in Kentbury, which wasn't too far from the School of Infantry at in Warminster in Wiltshire, so I was able to drive home for weekends and stay with my parents now and again. Still wasn't married. I'd had one or two sort of short, I would hardly call them affairs or even flirtations, I suppose, but friendliness with girls and never came to anything. There was one in came out in Salonika, who was temporary secretary to John Betjeman, who was a very studious girl, very beautiful. I got friendly with her, we used to go swimming. Then I met her again in England when she was up at Oxford, I think. But it slowly sort of fell apart when I was posted away somewhere, and that never happened.
You have to be quick.
Yeah, I don't think I was very keen on getting married at that time. I didn't want to settle down, I don't think. I think she was rather keen on settling down, wanted to marry, but I didn't. I got posted away again somewhere. And
the pre-war army seemed to think that there was a certain incompatibility between being married young and being in the army.
Yes.
And I don't think marriage at an early stage in the career was encouraged.
It wasn't before the war.
Was it the same after the war?
I don't think there was any discouragement then. Of course, you didn't get marriage allowance till you were 26, I think, at the earliest. Of course, it was 30 before the war.
Yes.
And I can remember a couple which, before the war, got married. Well, a couple. There must have been the two of them for a marriage. Johnny Haythornthwaite, he was his name. He was a subaltern. He was a bit older than me. Delightful chap, another son of a parson, I remember, and he got married to a nice girl, but you had to get your CO's permission in those days to get married, and he was too young, he was under 30, and he lived in sin. I mean, he went off and they had to pay for their own renting of property, and that's anywhere they went. Nobody went to see them, I remember, because they were off limits, so to speak, as far as the CO was concerned. And I always remember some wife talking to me later, boasting of the fact, saying she was the first person that went to see them, as if it was rather daring to go off and see them. But they were definitely living in sin. But after the war, no, that didn't. There was a entirely different attitude to marriage after the war. I think, actually, whilst I was adjutant, my whole sort of... It's a full-time job. And your mind is totally applied to it, really. I mean, not to all the paperwork or anything like that, but just it's a 24-hour job, even in the mess or outside.
You haven't got time to be married.
You didn't get. I didn't get time to consider it, really. It would have been a diversion at that stage, I think. But I mean, it didn't mean to say I was on parade in the mess. Definitely not. But I don't know, you had to behave in a certain way. I mean, people would talk to you and treat you as a friend in the mess, but you had to be very careful because you knew a lot more that they didn't know about what was happening. You had, as an adjutant for that particular period, you had more power perhaps than anybody else in the battalion apart from the CO, and everybody knew it. So it was really up to you to be, not to be standoffish, but to be affable in the mess and talk to people and put them at their ease. Well, some of them may have been, you know, sort of this bloody awful adjutant, I don't think I want to talk to him anyway. But as I say, most of our time there was spent at the school room doing the, well, it was all doing these demonstrations. Anything from section positions, camouflage. We also had on occasions to lay out the full kit of a company with the lorries, with the trucks lined up, all the what would go in the trucks all laid down by the side of them, all the weapons which would be used perhaps in support, maybe mortars there with their bombs at the side and so forth, so that they could see what an establishment was of that particular...
A Lloyd Infantry Company?
No. The trucks would be the 1,500 weight trucks, which would be the platoon trucks.
Yes.
But not Lloyd Infantry, because we weren't Lloyd Infantry.
You're still on foot.
Oh, yes. But any infantry battalion.
How long were the courses at Warminster in those days?
Oh, gosh. I went back and did a company command as well myself later, but... I think 6 weeks a company commander was as much as that. I know they're fairly long, the company commander's courses. We weren't so much at that time concerned with the length of courses, really. Mm. All we were concerned about was when we were on stage.
Putting on the demonstration.
And we got these dates down in our programme. This one for the section commanders, this one for the platoon commanders, and this one for the company commanders, another one for the company commanders. This one... wherever it happened to be, this one with tanks and so forth, so a liaison had to be done. The chief instructor was the guy in the school with whom we worked. So the Jimmy Adams, the second in command, would meet the chief instructor and work out the whole program, and he would just tell him what was required.
Was that where the liaison was done with the other arms through the chief instructor?
Yes, yeah. And he would just say, well, this is the program, this is what we want you to do, and this is what you've got to do. And no doubt after some of our earlier demonstrations, he would have Jimmy Adams in and say, look, it's not quite what we wanted. You know, I know you did this sort of thing well, but it was good intentioned, but we didn't need you to do that. Mm. We want to emphasize this particular aspect of a battle or whatever it was they were showing. But normal training had to go on.
What was your own internal training?
Yes, our own company training had to go on because we couldn't just sit back there and just let people go off and do demonstrations and then come back and sit in the barracks. So ordinary individual and company platoon and company training went on at the back on Salisbury Plain behind us, because we had this village there which was... I'm trying to remember the name now.
Imber,
that's right, yes.
This was for street fighting.
Street fighting,
yes.
Yeah. So we used to go there and do some street fighting, I remember. Now, this was 1951. What was it happened in 1951?
1950 was the outbreak of the Korean War.
No, but there was a celebration in the UK in 1951. Was it the anniversary of a Crystal Palace, of the exhibition?
Great Exhibition.
Great Exhibition. Because I know our band had to go around and play at various places throughout the UK. And that's